Chapter 39, The Vision in the Cave. In contrast with the lush greenness of the Malabar coast, the Tamil country was harsh and desolate of aspect. As the train carried us from west to east across the vast plateau of the Deccan, and we passed through the struggling hutments of one sun-baked township after another, it was as though the earth was being stripped bare of vegetation, and as though the fewer the trees and bushes that were left, the more stunted and withered they became. With the landscape, the people too changed, becoming thinner, darker, and less pleasing of feature. By the time we reached Tiruvannamalai, we were in another world. It was sand rather than soil that we trod underfoot on our way to the ashram, and huge boulders, weathered by the millennial action of sun, rain, and wind into perfect smoothness and whiteness, that we saw on either side of the road rather than human habitations. In between rocks, as well as on wind-eroded hillocks and the level ground, tiny whitewashed shrines sprouted as though from thickly sown seed. Thorn bushes sprouted too, while cactus hedges, half-concealed mud huts shrouded in withered vines. Beyond, greyish-brown paddy fields, bordered with arica palms, stretched in uneven patchwork to the horizon, where low hills, blue with distance, were just visible through the haze. In this prehistoric world, the only things that flourished were the big, shady trees, which, judging by the freshness and abundance of their leafage, had found beneath the barren rock sources of nourishment known only to themselves. The ashram, which had grown up round Ramana Maharshi during the previous half century, was not only bigger than the one that had grown up round Ram Das, but ran on very different lines. We noticed this as soon as we took our seats for lunch. Down the middle of the dining hall ran a partition, which, stopping short of the wall at the far end, divided the greater part of the place into two sections. One section was reserved for Brahmins, the other for non-Brahmins. Despite our saffron robes and the fact that, as ascetics, we were beyond caste distinctions, even according to orthodox Hindu tradition, Satyapri and I were relegated to the non-Brahmin section, where we took our seats on a narrow strip of matting that ran the whole length of the hall. Scurrying along the closely packed rows, bare-legged attendants hastily deposited on the leaf plates dollops of rice and curry and small puddles of chili and onion soup and buttermilk. I noticed that the leaf plates were not large rectangles of freshly cut plantain leaf, green and rubbery, as in Malabar, but consisted of small withered leaves pinned together with thorns into rough discs, hardly bigger than a doily. At a signal from the far end of the hall, everybody started eating, and soon the loud slurping, sucking and smacking noises of Hindus in hearty enjoyment of a good meal was all that could be heard. Was it my fancy, or were the noises that came from the other side of the partition, where the Brahmins were eating, even more resounding than those that came from our own side? Glancing up from my plate, I saw through the forest of bowed heads and rhythmically removing right arms, a dark, dignified figure, in what looked like a pair of white briefs, seated at the far end of the hall at right angles to the rows of eaters. Close-cropped white hair gave him an alert, almost military look. His eyes seemed to miss nothing. It was the Maharshi. From where he sat, he could look down either side of the partition and see both Brahmins and non-Brahmins. Both Brahmins and non-Brahmins could see him, and what was even more important, the Brahmins could neither see the non-Brahmins nor be seen by them. After spending a few days at the ashram, where we slept in a barrack room-like dormitory with several dozen other male visitors, and a few days with friends in one of the bungalows outside the ashram gate, Satyapi and I started looking for a quieter and more convenient place to stay, somewhere near enough for us to be able to see the Miharshi regularly, and far enough away to ensure freedom from disturbance. We did not have to look very far. Behind the ashram rose the twin peaks of Arunachala, the Hill of Light, sacred throughout the Tamil country, the mere name of which had strangely, magically, drawn the 17-year-old Ramana to the spot more than 50 years earlier. Untold ages ago, in the Satya Yuga, the Age of Truth, it had been a great pillar of light, the top and bottom of which even the gods had been powerless to discern. With the passage of time and the gradual deterioration of the universe, the hill too had changed. In the Treta Yuga, it had become a heap of rubies. In the Dvapara Yuga, a heap of gold. And now, in the Kali Yuga, the Dark Age, it was a heap of stones. But even as a heap of stones, Arunachala had its charms. On the tree-covered slopes, where bands of monkeys roamed at will, shrines had been set up on precipitous ledges, and caves excavated wherever there were natural holes and clefts in the rock. Most of the caves were occupied, but a few empty, and into one of these we established ourselves. Before doing so, we sought the approval of the Maharshi, intercepting him on his way to the bathroom, which was not really allowed. We cast ourselves on the sand at his feet and asked for his blessing on the step we were about to take. Leaning heavily on his stick, and with body painfully bent, the frail old man listened gravely to what we had to say. Then, in two or three short, simple sentences, and with an expression of great kindliness, he not only assured us that we were doing the right thing and had his blessing, but urged us to persevere in our efforts to realize the truth. The cave we had selected was known as the Virupaksha Guha, and it was situated on the southeast slope of the hill, overlooking the spacious courtyards and lofty gopurams of the Tiruvannamalai temple, at the end of a short sandy track that branched off from the main path up the hillside. Beyond the cave, where water slowly trickled down a dark crevice, a tangle of pink oleanders, 7 or 8 feet tall, made a pleasant contrast with the sunlit grey rock. Inside the cave, which was big enough to shelter 4 or 5 persons, it was surprisingly warm and dry. Indeed, despite the good ventilation, the warmth was almost oppressive. Much of the space was occupied by a raised stone structure on which we slept at night. This was the tomb of the saint after whom the cave was named, who had lived there 500 or 600 years ago and had been buried there. The place was also associated with the early life of the Maharshi. 2 years after his arrival in Tiruvannamalai, he had abandoned the shrines and temples in which he had stayed till then, and started living on the hill itself. The Virupaksha Guha was the cave to which he had resorted first, and in which he had stayed longest. Whether on account of the presence of the dead saint, or its associations with the living one, or simply because it was a cave, the place has an atmosphere of peculiar intensity. According to popular belief, the mantra Om could be distinctly heard there. Neither Satyapriya nor I ever heard this or any other mantra, but there was no denying that at times the vibrations of the cave were of such intensity that we seemed to hear a kind of buzzing or humming sound. We heard other sounds as well. For the first few days of our stay, we had to share the cave with a young Tamil, so thin and black and saucer-eyed as to seem like one of the hungry ghosts I had seen at Muvattaputza. Since we did not know Tamil, and he spoke neither Hindi nor English, we were unable to talk to each other. But at night there was no lack of communication, from his side at least. His food, which he cooked outside the entrance of the cave, consisted principally of red chilies, with the result that he was a chronic sufferer from flatulence. At intervals during the night, Satchipri and I would be woken up by reports like pistol shots, which, in the confined space, crashed and rolled around us for minutes on end. In our way of life, and even in our appearance, we were now virtually indistinguishable from all the other hermits and ascetics who dwelt on the sacred hill. Like them, we rose before dawn. Like them, we meditated until the early morning sun glittered clean and bright above the white ground mist. And like them, having taken the prescribed bath, we descended on the town of Tiruvannamalai for alms. Most of the sadhus actually begged from door to door. In our case, the friends with whom we had been staying at the bungalow had arranged for us to take our one meal of the day at a house in the Brahmin quarter of the town, where they had entered into an agreement with the occupier. Our host, an elderly Tamil Brahmin, fed us generously, but he was apparently quite unable to understand that non-Tamil throats, stomachs and intestines were simply incapable of dealing with the same huge quantities of red chilies to which he was accustomed. Every meal was therefore agony. Gulping water at frequent intervals, we ate with streaming eyes and noses and burning throats, while our well-meaning host, convinced that we must be enjoying it, stood over us with brass pot and ladle, warmly urging us to take another helping. On our way back to the cave, we usually took the shortcut through the Tiruvannamalai temple, skirting the second of the three massive walls that girdled the inner precincts. Strict rules governed the right of entry into the place. Untouchables could not enter at all. Indeed, they were not permitted even to pass too close to the outermost wall of the temple. Those who, though not actually untouchables, were still of low caste, could enter, but only so far as the grassy space between the second and third walls, where our own shortcut lay. High-caste Hindus could pass at will through the gates of all three walls, though Brahmins alone enjoyed the ultimate privilege of access to the Holy of Holies. Knowing that as a Malekka, I ranked even lower than the untouchables, and that I was not really entitled to enter as far as I did, I had no intention of trying to penetrate further into the temple. What the Hindus did in their own places of worship, and who they admitted there, was for them to decide, not me. One day, however, despite my reluctance, Satyapriya insisted on our exploring the whole temple complex. To our surprise, we found that the inner precincts within the third wall were more spacious than we could have imagined. Shrines and Shiva lingams stood everywhere, while stone canopies floated on forests of slender columns. Yet such were the dimensions of the place that there was no sense of crowding. Indeed, the gate towers through which we had just passed seemed so far away that it was difficult to believe that they were part of the same building. Worshippers with trays of offerings came and went. Ascetics, black and near naked, squatted on the steps of shrines, or lay motionless in the shade of trees. Humped sacred bulls, white and placid, stood munching discarded marigold garlands beside their stone brethren. Nobody took the slightest notice of us, or even appeared to see us. Eventually, having negotiated a maze of courtyards and corridors, we found ourselves leaning against a stone barrier and looking through doorway on doorway into the black recesses of the inmost shrine. As it was still winter, and by Indian standards not very hot, much of our time was spent out of doors. Having recovered from the immediate effects of our meal in town, we usually passed the remainder of the day until nightfall in a shady spot, not far from the mouth of the cave. Amid the primal simplicities of Arunachala, books seemed out of place, and though we had borrowed a few volumes from the ashram library, we dipped into them only occasionally, for inspiration rather than information. Indeed, with the possible exception of the Song of Dattatreya, The only work that made any impression on me at all at this period was Evans Wentz's Tibetan Yoga and Secret Doctrines, a copy of which had been presented to the ashram by a Western devotee, and with which the Maharshi was well acquainted. Most of our time we spent simply looking at the scene spread out before us, or walking slowly up and down these sandy paths. Within the diminished rectangle of the Tiruvannamalai temple, into which we now looked, as the gods must have looked from Mount Ida down at the walls of Troy, even the biggest shrines had shrunk to insignificance, while human figures swarmed like ants. As night fell, and the gate towers rose shadowy and insubstantial in the gloom, they would float up to us, faint with distance, the noise of conches calling to evening worship, the long drawn-out wailing note suddenly shattering itself in an angry explosion of sound. As though in reply, drums and gongs would start beating, their rhythms gradually becoming more and more insistent. Then, when the sound had built up into a crescendo, and the climax of the worship finally reached, there would be a sudden blaze of lights in the middle of the rectangle, where the shadows were deepest. Momentarily revealed by the blaze, we would see round the doorway of the main shrine, all stretching out their hands to the lights and struggling to get in, a dense crowd of people. As we watched, and as shouts and cries rose confusedly into the night air, something of the tumult and excitement of the worship would communicate itself to us across the intervening spaces. Soon, however, it would all be over. The temple would return to darkness and silence, and Satyapriya and I would be left alone on the hillside, watching the sky grow brighter and brighter with stars, until, with the rising of the mists, we were forced to retire into the dry, warm depths of the cave. Long before dawn, as well as at intervals throughout the day and night, we heard the temple bell. Perhaps it was my imagination, but I seemed always to hear the temple bell. It was not really one bell, but two bells that I heard, the first being slightly higher in pitch than the second. But the twin strokes came so close together, and were at once so well contrasted and so well harmonized, that they constituted, for me, a single experience. As a single experience, I referred them to a single origin, and thought of the sound as being produced by one bell, or rather by a kind of double bell which was struck, perhaps, either by two hammers in one place, or in two places by one hammer. The bell sounded louder than any of the instruments that accompanied the evening worship, louder than all of them combined. It was so loud that it penetrated rock as easily as air, so loud that it made no difference whether we were inside the cave or outside it. When we were inside the cave, indeed, it was as though the great bell swung not somewhere inside the temple, but up in the air, directly outside the cave. Sometimes I heard it in my dreams. Hour after hour it seemed to toll, incessant and insistent, wave after wave of brazen sound, breaking upon me like the repeated thunder of surf on the seashore. Sometimes it was as though the bell, swinging outside, was striking against the hill, and that the hill was the bell, and the bell itself the hammer that struck the bell. Again, the hill was not bell but anvil, and the bell the hammer that, stroke after sonorous stroke, smote upon the anvil. The point of impact, the point where the hill and bell met, where hammer smote anvil, was the cave, was me. Between the hill and the bell, between the anvil and the hammer, I was being reshaped, was being beaten into something I knew not what. I was being changed. Every two or three days, Satyapriya and I went to the ashram, finding our way along the network of footpaths that skirted the lower slopes of Arunachala. In the early morning sunshine, it was a pleasant walk. Past shrines and hermitages we went, some freshly whitewashed, others so tumbled down as to resemble heaps of stones. Past tangles of scrubby bushes and clumps of grey-green cacti with yellow flowers. At one point, our way led through a small secluded valley, lying in between the main hill to the north and two or three small foothills to the south. In this spot, I regularly experienced an intensity of silence and tranquility that I did not find in the ashram, even at the Maharshi's feet. It was as though someone even greater than the Maharshi had once dwelt there, and as though the whole valley was still filled with his invisible presence. Nevertheless, the darshan at the ashram was a truly memorable experience. By the time we arrived, the Maharshi was generally established in his usual place on the couch at the far end of the hall, where he would either recline against a bolster or, though more rarely, sit up cross-legged. Sometimes we arrived early enough to hear the chanting of the Vedas by a group of Tamil Brahmins with which the morning darshan began. What with the harsh, unmusical sound of the chanting and the hard, unsympathetic faces of the Brahmins, I could not help thinking of Venkateshvara Iyer. After the chanting was over, and the Brahmins had filed out of the hall, not much seemed to happen. The Maharshi sat on his couch. From time to time, someone would approach him with a question or a request, would receive a brief reply, sometimes no more than a look or a gesture, and would then return to his place. That was all. The rest of the time, the 60 or 70 people sitting in the hall either simply looked at the Maharshi, which was what the word darshan literally meant, or else closed their eyes and meditated. Talking was by no means prohibited, and muted greetings would sometimes be exchanged between new arrivals and friends in the congregation. But for the most part, the devotees sat quiet and motionless hour after hour, and a great silence reigned in the hall. One could not sit there for long without becoming aware that this silence was not a mere absence of sound, but a positive spiritual influence, even a spiritual force. It was as though a light breeze blew down the hall, or as though a stream flowed through it, a stream of purity. And this breeze, this stream, seemed to emanate from the silent, nodding figure on the couch, who did nothing in particular, only reading the letters that were brought to him, or glancing, every now and then, at some member of the congregation, with a keen but kindly eye. Sitting there in the hall with Satchapriya, I felt the stream flow over me, felt it flow over body and mind, over thoughts and emotions, until body, mind, thought and emotion had all been washed away, and there remained nothing but a great shining peace. Since our excursions to the ashram were intended solely for the purpose of darshan, we did our best to avoid spending time in merely social contacts, and took as little notice as possible of the new arrivals who were constantly turning up, many of whom would have been only too glad to have found out more about us. One new arrival, however, it was impossible for us to ignore. This was no less a person than the same amiable Shankaracharya of Puri, whom I had met in Ahmedabad 2 years earlier, and with whom I had afterwards corresponded. Entering the hall one morning, we found there not only a slightly larger concourse of people than usual, but the little Shankaracharya himself in full regalia, seated at the far end of the hall on a level with the Maharshi. A throne, with a tiger skin draped over it, had been set up for him at the foot of the Maharshi's couch, and there he sat, impassive, his silver staff of office firmly gripped in his right hand, the ancient confronting the modern representative of Advaita Vedanta. As everybody in the ashram appreciated, it was an historic occasion. Shankaracharyas of Puri did not usually go out of their way to show respect to other dignitaries, even of their own school, and the visit was an honour indeed. When we paid our respects to him in the tent, in which, for reasons of orthodoxy, he had been accommodated, I found him no less frank and liberal-minded than on the occasion of our first meeting. "Why should he not pay the Maharshi a visit?" he asked, "even if he was the Shankaracharya of Puri. He had heard much about him, and wanted to see him." Other statements reflected the same mild unorthodoxy. "He maintained the external trappings of his position," he declared, "and observed all the orthodox socio-religious taboos, because this was what the majority of his followers expected of him. He himself, however, attached very little importance to them. Since our last meeting, I had come to learn that there was another Shankaracharya of Puri in existence, and that this rival claimant to the office was in physical possession of the math, or monastic headquarters of the line, at Puri in Orissa. Were there in fact two Shankaracharyas of Puri, I asked, and if so, how had the division arisen? The little Shankaracharya laughed. "The regalia is with me," he said simply. And as we could see, with him it was. And that apparently settled the matter. Though Satchapriya and I kept ourselves free of all social contacts, we were certainly interested in whatever spiritual activities might be going on within the sphere of the Maharshi's immediate influence. One day, we visited the little colony of ascetics that had sprung up to the west of the ashram. Huts and hermitages alike were built on the smallest scale, like doll's houses, and from the simplest materials. Silver-grey mud walls were crowned with palm thatch of faded greyish-brown, while cow-dung ochred courtyards were enclosed by wattle and daub fences, in which every stick stood out beneath the thin coating of mud, like ribs and veins beneath the skin. Despite the perfect neatness and cleanliness of the place, there was no sign whatever of human life. The diminutive buildings might well have been the work of ants or bees, or of some shy, delicate-handed pygmy race that, scenting the approach of man, had silently melted into the ground. In one of the tiny courtyards, no more than 8 or 10 feet in diameter, stood a papaya tree, the top of its straight, slender trunk as thickly hung with fruits as the Diana of Ephesus with breasts. Satchapriya pushed open the low wattle and daub gate. Then, crossing the courtyard, he quietly pushed open the light wooden door. Inside was a single, small room, completely bare, and inside the room, almost directly facing us, there sat, meditating, the most beautiful young man I had ever seen. Slim and fair-complexioned, he sat there with closed eyes, beautiful not only on account of his perfectly proportioned body, naked save for a small cloth, but even more so on account of the beatific smile that irradiated his face. He was quite oblivious to our presence. Unable to take our eyes off him, we stood there for several minutes. Then, having closed the door behind us, even more gently than we had opened it, we slowly made our way back to the ashram. Despite frequent changes of abode during the previous few months, Satchapriya and I had not neglected our own practice of meditation. Wherever we might happen to be, we sat without fail, morning and evening. While we were at Anand Ashram, this had led, in my case, to some interesting side effects. One afternoon I discovered I had a temperature. Though it was alarmingly high, so high that Satchapriya, on feeling me with his hand, at first wanted to call the doctor, I did not feel the least unwell. Indeed, I felt blissful, almost ecstatic, while the heat itself seemed to envelop the whole body in a melting sensation of infinite warmth, comfort and security. The experience lasted 2 days. When we told Ram Dass about it, he pointed out that tapasya, the ancient Sanskrit word for spiritual practice, literally meant the generation of heat, and said that the experience signified the burning up of all impurities. Now that we were staying at the Virupaksha Guha and devoting most of our time to meditation, even more extraordinary experiences were only to be expected, nor is it astonishing that some of them should seem to indicate the course of future developments. One night I found myself, as it were, out of the body, and in the presence of Amitabha, the Buddha of Infinite Light, who presides over the western quarter of the universe. The colour of the Buddha was a deep, rich, luminous red, like that of rubies, though at the same time soft and glowing, like the light of the setting sun. While his left hand rested on his lap, the fingers of his right hand held up, by the stalk, a single red lotus in full bloom, and he sat in the usual cross-legged posture on an enormous red lotus that floated on the surface of the sea. To the left, immediately beneath the raised arm of the Buddha, was the red hemisphere of the setting sun, its reflection glittering golden across the waters. How long the experience lasted, I do not know, for I seemed to be out of time as well as out of the body, but I saw the Buddha as clearly as I had ever seen anything under the ordinary circumstances of my life, indeed far more clearly and vividly. The rich red colour of Amitabha himself, as well as of the two lotuses, and the setting sun, made a particularly deep impression on me. It was more wonderful, more appealing than any earthly red. It was like red light, but so soft and at the same time so vivid, as to be altogether without parallel. In the course of the next few days, I composed a series of stanzas describing the vision. Contrary to my usual practice, I failed to write them down afterwards, with the result that they gradually faded from my mind. But the experience itself never faded. Nearly a quarter of a century later, the figure of the Red Buddha is as clear to me in recollection as it was the next morning in the Virupaksha Guha. With the approach of summer, the atmosphere in the cave had, by this time, not only lost its freshness, but become quite stuffy. Satchipriya and I therefore decided to move to a square, stone-built shrine that stood lower down at the very foot of the hill. Better ventilated than the cave, and extremely cool, it consisted of a single chamber about 6 foot square, divided into two sections. One section was occupied, from wall to wall, by a low stone platform, on which one of us slept at night, while in the other a lingam of polished black stone, 8 or 10 inches high, had been let into an anvil-shaped yoni sunk in the middle of the floor. Though involving such a short distance, our removal from the higher to the lower slopes of Arunachala was not without significance. The vision in the cave had convinced me that our 2 years' apprenticeship to the holy life had come to an end, and that we must now retrace our steps to North India and seek formal ordination in one of the Buddhist centres there. My desire for ordination had indeed become unbearably intense. In waking fantasy, I saw myself living as a monk at Sarnath, where the Buddha delivered his first discourse, and thought that if I could only live there, sweeping the temple steps every morning, it would be the height of happiness. The truth was, perhaps, that after living so long in the midst of Hinduism, I was now homesick, as it were, for Buddhism, and wanted not only to experience it in my own life, but to see it in tangible form all about me. Our removal from the cave to the shrine seemed the first step in this direction. Before we could be permitted to leave Tiruvannamalai, however, Arunachala had a few more experiences in store for us. The black stone cubicle which we shared with the sacred lingam was not only cooler than the cave, but more accessible to visitors. And in the course of the 10 or 12 days that remained, Satchipriya and I became objects of interest to some of the more eccentric members of the local ascetic community. Our most persistent visitor, who ended by calling several times a day, was a thin, dark, active woman with straggling iron-grey hair, who lived in a small shrine dedicated to the goddess Durga on the road to Tiruvannamalai. We called her Tessilda's mother. This was because she was constantly impressing on us, in her broken English, that she had a son, and that this son was not only a very good boy, but had done extremely well for himself, being now a Tesilda, or subdivisional officer, somewhere in Andhra. Her speech and gestures were habitually wild, almost crazy. Whenever she came to see us, she brought various titbits that she had cooked for us, and insisted on feeding us with her own hands. Once she decorated us as though we were sacred images, anointing our foreheads with sandalwood paste, tucking flowers into the tops of our waistcloths, and finally planting a generous full kiss on our lips. Another regular visitor was an ancient saffron-clad ascetic, whom we nicknamed Swami Ek So At, or Swami 108. 108 was the sacred, or at least auspicious, Hindu number. There were 108 Upanishads, 108 places of pilgrimage, 108 beads to a rosary, and even, as we had discovered when we were invited to a wedding feast in Muvattaputsa, 108 chutneys. There were also 108 shrees before the name of any extraordinarily holy or auspicious personage, though instead of actually writing Shri 108 times, which would take up a lot of space, one could write the figure 108 instead. The old ascetic in question, who had the plausible air of the professional impostor, informed us early in our acquaintance that he was entitled to this distinction, and that when we wrote to him after our departure, which he seemed to think we were bound to do, we should be sure to address the letter to Swami Shri 108 blank. We therefore called him Swami Ek So At. Among his disciples, he told us, there were a large number of princesses. All these princesses had realized the truth. How had they realized it? Simply by their devotion to him. Whenever he stayed with them in their palaces in northwestern India, they waited on him personally, he declared. Such was their devotion to him, and that no service was too mean or too humble for them to perform. They even washed his kopin. The kopin was the narrow strip of cloth traditionally worn as a jockstrap by Hindu ascetics, and an old one, hanging up to dry, was not a particularly attractive sight. Since there were no princesses around in Arunachala, Swami Ek So At was, for the time being, having to wash his own kopin. But any woman, he averred, who washed it for him every day for 2 years, or at the most 3 years, would be sure to realize the truth. Though we at first listened to these claims in silence, after the third or fourth repetition, Satyapriya could not forbear asking for further details of the princess's devotion, thus leading the old man into such absurdities that eventually, unable to contain ourselves, we both burst out laughing. Tesilda's mother was more direct. On being told that it was high time that she too started thinking of realizing the truth, she roundly declared that she would rather not realize it at all than realize it by such means. When Swami Ek So At retorted that she was lacking in devotion, she retaliated by calling him an old fraud. In the noisy altercation that followed, Tesilda's mother won an easy victory, at least verbally, and the old man was forced to concede the field. He did not retire from the conflict, however, without a parting shot. Anxious to wash his kopin, two or three young and beautiful princesses were at that very moment on their way to Arunachala, he shouted angrily. When they arrived, she would see with what devotion they served him. Tesilda's mother tossed her grey locks. Oh, yes, he said, with a scornful laugh. She would see. Strange to relate, a few days afterwards, we noticed that Swami Ek So At did have quite a number of female disciples with him. But whether they were princesses, and whether they washed his kopin, we never discovered. The third and last of our regular visitors was perhaps more truly representative of the ascetic community. shaven-headed and wearing only a small white loincloth. He passed our door every morning in the course of his daily circumambulation of the sacred hill, and soon got in the habit of stopping for a chat. Though he could not have been more than 35, he was thin and emaciated in the extreme, like an old man, and it was soon apparent that he hardly ever took any food. He was not interested in food. This was due not to excessive asceticism, as we at first supposed, but to reasons of a very different nature. Like so many other Hindu ascetics, our friend was an inveterate smoker of ganja, or Indian hemp. Ganja enabled one to see God. Ganja se Shivji ka darshan milta hai, he told us simply, in response to our inquiry. One day, when we were out for a walk, we happened to see him sitting in the shade of a tamarind tree, not far from the road. At his invitation, we joined him. With him were three or four other ascetics of various ages, all raggedly clad in different shades of saffron. Though less emaciated than our friend, they were of a dull and bestial appearance, and looked at us, if they looked at all, with glazed eyes. That they saw God, there was no evidence, apart from the fact that they were smoking ganja. After we had sat there for a few minutes, one of them offered a little of the herb, first to Satchapriya and then to me. We both refused it, saying that we did not smoke. An expression of surprise flickered for a moment on their faces. One of them remarked that, if we did not smoke ganja, we were not true sadhus, and relapsed into indifference. Perhaps he was right. Perhaps we were not true sadhus after all. In any case, we were now on the point of departure from Tiruvannamalai, and had no time to pursue the matter further.